UOP Multimedia presents The Ominous Continuity with Kevin Cole, creating insights on the history of Western civilization, international relations, education theory, technology, and current events. This is Episode 7, The Roundtable in the History of International Relations. Welcome back to the Ominous Continuity Podcast, produced by UnityOfThePolis.com. My name is Kevin Cole, and in this long overdue episode, we're going to cover the hidden history of international relations, academic discipline creation as a strategy for imperialism, and explore the methods, motivation, and mind state of the think tanks that have constituted our insular, unelected, and transnational ruling class. Today's article is from 2017 and is titled Imperial Mission, Scientific Method, An Alternative Account of the Origins of IR, by Vineet Thacker, Alexander E. Davis, and Peter Vail. This article offers an alternative account of the origins of academic international relations and how the creation of a racially ordered state in South Africa served as a template for the British Commonwealth and later the world state. It follows the British Dominion tours of Lionel Curtis, founder of the Royal Institute of International Affairs between September 1909 and March 1911, and the imperial enthusiast who placed enormous trust in the scientific method to create a unified empire, and how these methods and ideas became central of the new discipline of international relations. I'd like to say a special thanks for all of your ongoing encouragement and support. If you do appreciate my research and analysis and would like to help fund future projects of UOP Multimedia, you can support my work directly at UnityOfThePolis.com. Or consider becoming my patron at patreon.com/KevinColeUOP. You can also do so by picking up a copy or subscription to my UOP Research Brain, which is a historical database and mind map containing over 11,000 individual entries and 27,000 links, which I've been compiling since 2009. If you have any questions, interview requests, topic suggestions, or anything at all, please feel free to contact me directly. With that in mind, this is The Ominous Continuity. Thanks for listening. Imperial Mission, Scientific Method, An Alternative Account of the Origins of International Relations, by Vineet Thacker, Alexander E. Davis, and Peter Vail. Introduction. For almost a century, international relations has held us captive to the lore of an epistemological Big Bang, endlessly repeated in lecture halls, scholarly outputs, and textbooks as the view that IR began in 1919 with the founding of the Department of International Politics at what is now called Aberystwyth University in Wales. This natal moment was followed by the establishment of the British, later Royal Institute of International Affairs, otherwise called Chatham House, in London. The conventional account holds that these events occurred in the wake of the horrors of World War I. The new discipline, we are told, was inspired by the belief that the scientific study of international politics would help avoid future conflicts and promote global peace. Recent revisionist interventions on the development of the field have done an excellent job in challenging the Aberystwyth-centered account and its whitewashing of the discipline's racist past. These histories have focused on revealing the Eurocentrism of IR theory, on the role of specific thinkers such as Alfred Zimmern, John Hobson, Gilbert Murray, and Leonard Wolff, considering the role of imperialism in early IR thought, and on specific national context. Particularly important has been Robert Vitalis's work on the U.S., which has shown how the discipline grew out of the science of racial development and was used deep into the Cold War to support imperial interests in the maintenance of global white supremacy. However, these revisionist histories are also limited by a focus on experiences of individual states, most commonly the U.S. and the U.K. The development of IR as a global discipline was surely only possible through a transnational circulation of key ideas such as sovereignty, empire, commonwealth, and especially the notion of the international. In these pages, we add two new elements of IR's revisionist historiography. First, we will show that many of these ideas were developed and sharpened not in imperial power centers, but from the margins. Indeed, South Africa, Johannesburg in particular, became the laboratory of such ideas and their first implementation. These ideas were then circulated, molded, and formalized through networks of people and institutions throughout the British Empire. Indeed, IR could not have become a global discipline without these networks spreading its ideas. Second, we argue that the Roundtable Movement, an empire-wide community of imperial enthusiasts founded in Britain in 1909, dispersed these ideas, as it provided the institutional setting and the method for the scientific study of international affairs. A strong belief in the scientific method being the vehicle through which the ideas of an imperial international would become a reality was epistemized in the founding, production, and dissemination of the movement's journal, The Roundtable. Interestingly, The Roundtable, which remains today an international relations journal, started publication in the same year as the Journal of Race Development, which Vitalis has termed the first IR journal. Alfred Zimmerman, Lionel Curtis, and Philip Kerr, the first chair at Aberystwyth, founder of Chatham House, and the founding editor of the Roundtable respectively, were not only close academic collaborators, but also active participants in the Roundtable movement. Furthermore, the instruments of the discipline scientific study within the British and the interwar period, IR academic chairs, journals, and institutes, were largely the initiatives of the same episteme. So not only were most of the newly established IR chairs occupied by Roundtable members, but the interwar IR institutes opened in Canada, Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, and India drew upon the same network. Each was institutionally tied to Chatham House. These institutes, accepting their Indian iteration, were based on the Roundtable societies founded by Curtis during his Dominion tour, which occupies our attention below. Moreover, in the 1940s, most of them established IR journals, which drew upon Curtis's original methodology and mission in their editorials, the gathering of facts for the bringing about of world peace. In excavating both the Roundtable and its prehistory in South Africa, we'd also draw attention to another of IR's fables. We are told that E.H. Carr's classic, 20 Years Crisis, first challenged the vain moralism of the world peace narrative of international relations at the cusp of World War II, and that the resulting disciplinary narrative was grounded in a realist analysis of international politics. Revisionists have critiqued Carr's characterization of writers like Alfred Zimmerman, Norman Angell, Woodrow Wilson, Arnold Toynbee as idealist. But scant attention was paid to the fact that Carr's own understanding of idealism neatly fitted a celebrated text which was published a few months before Carr started writing his acclaimed book. The text in question was the 3-volume study entitled Civitas Dei, which was written by the founder of Chatham House, Lionel Curtis. Curiously, Carr, who was an associate of Chatham House, omits a mention of Curtis in his book, In the 20-Year Crisis, but Curtis's book can be seen as the invisible thesis to Carr's antithesis because it unabashedly champions the cause of world commonwealth. Curtis and this book loom large in this essay. Central to our argument is both that Carr and international relations disciplinary history are silent on the notion that the realization of world peace through a world commonwealth was modeled on a real-world event, the formation of a Union of South Africa in 1910. Its immediate backdrop, the Second Anglo-Boer War, had forced the politicians and intellectuals in 4 colonies of southern Africa to transfer their individual sovereignties into a union. In South Africa, this task had been promoted by a committed group of young men who successfully used knowledge and the instruments of its propagation, institutions, journals, the formal exchange of ideas, to achieve these imperial goals. But there is another silence in Carr's analysis, the issue of race. While denouncing early theory for its lack of realism, Carr elevates it to a moral high ground. In doing so, he also sanitizes its deep and regressive racism. An understanding of race as natural was common to all political analysis until World War II, but curiously, Carr's and later international relations equation of idealism with morality erases race from the disciplinary memory. We argue here that the Roundtable was actually based on an earlier effort called Closer Union Societies, which was formed in South Africa in 1908. The journal Roundtable was modeled on a bilingual South African-based journal, The State, which was published from 1908 to 1912. Moreover, the ideas, methods of work, research, and propaganda of the Roundtable were pioneered by the same thought collective that had operated in the post-Boer War of South Africa and had successfully secured this political union. Through an archival journey into the founding of the Roundtable, we trace the emergence of some central ideas and methods through two of its early initiatives, the formation of the Union of South Africa and Curtis's Dominion Tour from September 1909 to March 1911. The latter sought to extend South African experience into the global arena. Its success depended on techniques developed to secure the former. Acting in tandem, they secured a, quote, scientific method, which was and continues to be at the heart of international relations founding's identity. Curtis's scheme. Our history begins in the first weekend of September 1909, when Lord Anglesey's golf course and cricket pavilion at Plas Newydd in North Wales hosted a series of meetings presided over by Lord Alfred Milner, who had been High Commissioner to South Africa from 1897 to 1905. The gathering was attended by Lionel Curtis, Robert H. Brand, and Philip Kerr, three of Milner's protégés during his years in South Africa, and part of a group known as Milner's Kindergarten, William Maris, a New Zealand-born member of the Indian Civil Service, and G.L. Craik, both of whom were closely associated with Milner's Kindergarten. F.S. Oliver, a businessman who'd recently written a biography of Alexander Hamilton and strongly influenced members in the kindergarten, and one Rob Holland, who's not been identified, but might have been a Cape Town civil servant who was a secretary to Dr. Leander Starr Jameson, infamous leader of the Jameson Raid, who was later Prime Minister of the Cape Colony, Lord Lovat, who had raised a regiment to fight in the Anglo-Boer War, Arthur Maitland, Milner's secretary, and Viscounts Howick and Walmer, son-in-law and son of Lord Selborne, then the incumbent High Commissioner to South Africa. The meetings discussed, as Milner wrote in his diary, quote, Curtis's scheme, a set of proposals for reshaping the British Empire, whose naval supremacy and political hegemony was being challenged by Germany, Japan, and the United States. Two of these constituted direct threats to Britain, Japan, a rising non-white empire in the East, and Germany, which was an adversary of Britain in Europe and also in East and Southern Africa, was regarded as the antithesis of both British values and the Anglo-Saxon systems of government. The United States was seen in somewhat ambiguous terms. It certainly shared a history and a set of values as part of the Anglo-Saxon world, but it offered a successful model of republicanism and a rebellion that promised success outside of the imperial family. Consequently, it was seen as rebellious as an offspring whose entry into the family alliance of Greater Britain was desirable. Concurrently, its success was begrudged as it offered an example to the dominions of the opportunities of separation from the Anglo-Saxon family. These anxieties provoked the necessity to refashion the empire into an alliance of states that would share responsibility for imperial defense and would be less hierarchical and more egalitarian, at least for its white subjects. Those attending the gathering at Plas Newydd believed, following South Africa's transition to sovereign statehood, then still a few months away, that the settler colonies in the empire would all achieve, quote, sovereignty, a development that would itself require a reconfiguration of the empire. Without independent powers of decision in respect to domestic foreign policy and defense, however, the dominions could not really claim to enjoy full sovereignty. At the time, Britain could not afford the military expenditure that was needed to sustain its imperial hegemony, so the dominions were required to help defend the empire. And Britain had to give a stronger voice in domestic and foreign matters, and in governing the empire itself. Proposals for this approach were encapsulated under the notion of imperial unity. In a key passage, in a memorandum recording conversations between a few English and South African friends during the summer of 1909, Curtis described imperial unity as, quote, only means of securing the political ideals of the race, real nationality and self-government to those capable of exercising it, and to those which are not, government in the interest of the governed themselves. For those at the gathering at Plas Newydd, then the notion of empire was not only about the need to maintain imperial hegemony, but also about fostering self-government. Given this, they believed the shift towards imperial unity was the culmination of the true ideal of the British Empire. Having established their ultimate objective, the group's interest then moved to the issue of how to bring this about. Participants believed that, quote, imperial unity would not come about on its own. Rather, achieving this would require a dedicated set of public men in distant communities who were animated by common purpose, who would be required to work in a unity of method. If these deferred, there would be a conflict among the devotees, and a cause of imperial unity would fail. Therefore, they had to pursue one general plan simultaneously within five settler communities. Failing this, the danger was that the forces available may lose themselves in aspirations. But what method would secure this goal? While this remained largely undecided, a few preliminary steps were taken at the meeting. First, a deputation would be sent to each of the dominions. Through a process of personal selection in each dominions, the deputies would carefully select a small group of imperial enthusiasts. Once these were nominated, an executive agent would be appointed for each of the groups that would be responsible for carrying out its activities. In order to make this empire-wide scheme effective, a core group would have to work in London, the imperial center. In addition, an itinerant delegate would visit various groups in order to collect, digest, and disseminate information. From this consultation, an imperial statement emerged setting out the alternatives involved, the real problem of disruption, the sacrifices needed to avoid it, and the successive stages through which the ultimate goal is to be sought. Once this was issued, its goals would be taken up by all groups as a creed to which all have contributed and all have subscribed. Two things were noted at the first meeting. First, the movement should avoid making the imperial statement public, responding only to, quote, genuine and responsible queries. Second, the movement should avoid identification with any political party. As Milner noted in his diary, all of these points came from Curtis, but the scheme had its roots in South Africa. We now turn our attention to these roots, to look at the ways in which IR's original methods and identity were honed by the kindergarten's effort to construct a state in South Africa, making the South African state. The Union of South Africa was established on May 31, 1910. 8 years earlier, the two defeated Boer republics, the Transvaal Republic and the Orange Free State Republic, had surrendered their sovereignty to the British Empire. Alfred Milner, who was then the British High Commissioner, and his young men, as Walter Nimitz called them, played a central role in bringing this about. Like many of his generation, Milner considered the British Empire to be a moral force for civilization. However, his idea of empire differed from the accepted norm. In his farewell speech in Johannesburg in March 1905, he declared, "The word empire, the word imperial, are in some respects unfortunate. They suggest domination, ascendance, the rule of a superior state over vassal states. When we, who call ourselves imperialists, talk about the British Empire, we think about a group of states, all independent in their own local concerns, but all united for the defense of their own common interest and the development of a common civilization. United not in alliance, for alliances can be made and unmade, but in a permanent organic union." For Milner, the empire was a group of white self-governing communities bound by a common, quote, civilization. The ultimate goal of the idea of empire, he argued, could only be a permanent organic union, where elements within an organism would gravitate towards each other in a, quote, natural way, and that each played a role in sustaining the entity as a whole. At the end of the Anglo-Boer War, Milner assumed the governorship of the Transvaal and the Orange River Colony. From these commanding heights, he embarked on a project of state building in what would become South Africa. The process began with the overhaul of the state's bureaucracy. In the years following the war, he recruited a group of young men, mainly from New College and Balliol College in Oxford, who shared his dream of a united Southern Africa. Derisively called Milner's Kindergarten, first by William Marriott, the group included Robert Brand, Patrick Duncan, Jeffrey Robinson, later Dawson, Richard Feetham, Dougal Malcolm, Hugh Wyndham, Lionel Hitchens, F. Peter Perry, Philip Kerr, John Dove, and Lionel Curtis. When Milner left South Africa in 1905, the kindergarten carried forward his project with the willing assistance of its successor, Lord Selborne. Although the kindergarten was tethered to Milner's name, its intellectuals went far beyond Milner and his work in South Africa. While Milner had provided a broad outline, Curtis and his colleagues fleshed out the details of the unification of the four colonies through a series of intellectual initiatives. These included the establishment in September 1906 of a close thought collective called the Fortnightly Club. Here, Milner's kindergarten met with other devotees of empire to discuss issues related to the formation of a united South Africa and its relations with and ramifications for the imperial project. Its proceedings were recorded in the Fortnightly Club collection, now archived at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. These papers record discussions on thoughts about sovereign statehood, racial segregation, the immigration of Asians, and imperial politics generally. A particular preoccupation of the club was the absence of an empire-wide theory of government. The existing British Empire, as Curtis argued in an early presentation to the Fortnightly Club, was the outcome of a series of contingent developments in Canada, Australia, South Africa, and India. As a result, the interrelationship between empire, state, and society, the three constituent features of an imperial community, were blurred. It was unclear what sovereignty might mean for each of the dominions, or indeed, what it might look like within the imperial project. Consequently, ideas around political authority within the empire were fragmented, and the relationship between entities was uncertain. Simply put, there was a worrying absence of a coherent theory of imperial rule. For Milner and his acolytes, South Africa was an important case study in imperial security and politics because it was a microcosm of the empire. They argued that just as the British Empire was threatened by other powers, especially Germany, the future of southern African colonies was threatened by the agitation of its African populations. How did they arrive at this comparison? During the Boer War, the other dominions had sent their forces to southern Africa to fight for the imperial cause. In the same way, the southern African colonies had dispatched troops to suppress the Bambatha Rebellion, which had broken out in the colony of Natal in 1905. This suggested a common threat to security could unify whites in southern Africa, as well as whites across the empire. Moreover, the southern African colonies were perhaps the most representative of the racial and immigrant, quote, problems of the empire as a whole. For one, they encapsulated an intra-civilizational European conflict which resembled the Irish question. This was the tense relationship between the Boer and the Brit in South Africa. But the country also reflected the empire-wide, quote, inter-civilizational line between the Europeans and non-Europeans. Here, two civilizational extremes were juxtaposed, the English and the Africans. Added to the social mix was the issue of Asians, who occupied a liminal space between these two racial extremes in South Africa, as well as within the empire. As immigrants, the question of their rights as subjects of the empire was being raised most vociferously in South Africa by a recent arrival, Mohandas Gandhi. South Africa became an important political laboratory for the kindergarten, with South African statehood seen as a precursor of, and a model for, their grand project of creating a, quote, organic union. While the club fleshed out these ideas, Curtis, with the help of other members in the kindergarten, prepared a missive called the Selborne Memorandum. In essence, it was a statement about the interdependent and mutually reinforcing relations of the four colonies that gestured towards the formation of a federal state. But a year later, in 1908, the kindergarten published a two-part volume entitled The Government of South Africa, which sets out the case for a unitary government in the country. It was written mostly by Lionel Curtis. Interestingly, the argument in the book had begun with the assumption that South Africa should become a federation. This idea followed a reading of Oliver's aforementioned biography of Alexander Hamilton, which pointed towards an American plan to create a federal structure for the ailing British Empire. But Curtis noted that his own inquiries into the actual facts had revealed that a political union was a more desirable option for South Africa. He emphasized that research had pulled his own thinking and that of the kindergarten towards the union option, in spite of their preconceived ideas. This signposting is crucial in explaining the development of international relations methodology, because Curtis often cited this as an example of, quote, scientific research, and how objective inquiry had persuaded the kindergarten to change their minds on important issues. From this point onward, the government of South Africa served as a methodological primer for all of Curtis's later works, including The Commonwealth of Nations and Civitas Dei. In 1908, the kindergarten embarked on two further projects, which later played an important role in their evolving, quote, scientific method of understanding the world. The first was established of a public association called Closer Union Societies. Second, the launching of a journal called The State. The purpose of the former was to propagate the establishment of a unified South African state within the British Empire. The latter was a vehicle that promoted the same ideas on behalf of Closer Union Societies. Conventional history suggests that politicians like Jan Smuts, John Merriman, and Louis Botha played a bigger role in establishing the Union of South Africa than did the kindergarten. However, the kindergarten understood itself as having a background role in the process. In a moment of self-congratulation, Lord Selborne wrote to Curtis saying, "I'm quite sure that if it had not been for the book, The Government of South Africa, we never should have gotten an excellent form of constitution. Although you had many splendid helpers, the main credit for this work must always be yours. Milner's kindergarten will have more profoundly influenced the history of South Africa than any combination of Afrikaners has ever done." It is important to note that the kindergarten based the legitimacy of their subsequent efforts to develop a theory and practice of thinking about world affairs almost entirely on their activities in South Africa. In other dominions, a belief took hold about 30 or 40 men that went and planted themselves in the different colonies of South Africa and accomplished the South African Union through research and propaganda. The scope of ideas on these issues evolved from organic union in the early 1910s to the British Commonwealth in the late 1910s to the world state in the 1930s. When challenged on the worth of these ideas and their evolution, Curtis would refer to South Africa, where the combination of research, knowledge, and propaganda had created a new political reality. With the Union of South Africa guaranteed, Curtis and the kindergarten turned their attention to the future of the empire itself. In a letter to Leo Amery in March 1909, he explained that in South Africa, the kindergarten had, quote, acted as an advance party of sappers sent out to build a vital section of road over which the main force will have to travel later on. As with the Selborne Memorandum, his initial challenge was to identify and state the imperial problem. This was to be done through a well-researched memorandum which would serve as a common reference for all Imperial Union enthusiasts. As Curtis had done in South Africa before writing the Selborne Memorandum, he would visit all the dominions in preparation of the new document. Once the imperial statement had been drafted, it would be shared with like-minded people across the dominions. They would promote a movement towards imperial union. He also insisted on launching a publication along the lines of the state, which would circulate their Imperial Union gospel. To succeed, they had to convince sympathetic people in London, particularly their patriarch and their patron, Lord Milner. In July and August of 1909, Milner presided over a series of meetings in and around London, attended by F.S. Oliver, Lord Lovat, Leo Amory, Leander Starr Jameson, and Milner's successor in South Africa, Lord Selborne. At these gatherings, Curtis, Brand, Kerr, and Robinson tried to convince the others of their plans for the future of the empire. It was at these events that led to the weekend retreat at Place Neuwied. As this project took place, however, the roundtable found themselves divided on how to imagine a future racialized world order. From organic union to commonwealth, debates about race. Given the green light to proceed at Place Neuwied's gathering, Curtis left England on September 17, 1909, on the Canadian leg of an 18-month tour of the British Dominions. On a 4-month tour of North America, he was accompanied by Philip Kerr and William Marist. They returned to England in January 1910. However, Curtis soon left again to visit South Africa, New Zealand, and Australia, returning to England in March of 1912. Whilst in Canada, Kerr also spent a month in the United States. This side trip is explained by his deepening interest in the racial question in the American South, which he regularly wrote about in the state. These ideas provide a crucial window on Curtis's scheme and the racist birth of IR, and complement recent work, especially that of Vitalis. The latter has certainly highlighted the fact that American ideas on race were central to early imaginings of the discipline in the making. The kindergarten's musing on these issues suggested the ideas of race and racial hierarchy enjoyed a wide transcontinental circulation. This understanding is reinforced by the fact that Philip Kerr's interest in segregation was not limited to South Africa. Instead, he projected the idea of racial segregation as a template for global relations. As late as 1916, in the first introductory text to international relations, Kerr wrote that the division of mankind on a, quote, graduated scale of civility and barbarism was one of the most fundamental facts in human history. Placing the clashes between the Japanese and Canadians alongside Gandhi's movement for the rights of Indians in South Africa, Kerr was worried that racial violence could become a commonplace across the empire. These fears were sparked by Japan's victory in the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 and 1905. In Canada, Kerr learned the tensions were brewing between Ottawa and Tokyo over restrictions on immigration from Japan. Characterizing Asians as alien elements whose entry into the Dominions must be prevented to preserve the white body politic, he argued that world peace could only be guaranteed if Asians and Europeans were isolated from one another. In praise of segregation, he wrote that, quote, two races shall never be allowed to intermingle in the same territory in the future. South Africa and North America have adopted this policy. It seems likely that the rest of the world will follow suit. While Kerr feared an interracial conflict, Curtis and Maris were revising their thoughts on race in the world. Curtis in particular had begun to worry about the, quote, Indian question in the scheme for organic union. Until this point, Curtis had strongly advocated a segregationist position in opposition to the liberal Darwinist belief that races could be, quote, civilized and assimilated. However, his ideas about race changed during the visit to Canada. Years later, in his 1920 Letter to the People of India, he recorded his change in thinking. It occurred during an exchange with Maris during a discussion of anarchism in India, where the latter expressed the view that British policy in India needed a guiding principle, and that the only conceivable one was, quote, self-government. In line with this, Britain's primary duty was to extend Western education to India, thus preparing Indians to govern themselves. This observation, Curtis confessed, was one of the milestones in his education. In 1907, Curtis's view had been that the white man's burden was not to drag non-Europeans to civilization, but to design the best form of government for maintaining the race barrier. He believed that the self-governing institutions were suitable only for those at the top of the civilizational ladder. Drawing a binary distinction between, quote, static and, quote, progressive societies, he had argued that all progressive white societies had developed institutions of self-government. Among these, Britons were the most advanced. In contrast, the non-Western societies, particularly Oriental ones, he regarded as static. Africa only had, quote, tribes, not even societies, in his view. At the time, Curtis believed that Britain had the responsibility of ruling static societies through a bureaucracy which was autocratic but efficient. However, his talk with Maris changed his view on these matters. Quote, it was from that moment that I first began to think of the government of each by each and all by all, not merely as a principle of Western life, but rather of all human life, as the goal to which all human societies must tend. He went on, quote, I began to think of the British Commonwealth as the greatest instrument ever devised for enabling that principle to be realized, not merely for the children of Europe, but for all races and hundreds of peoples and tongues. From that point forward, Curtis confessed, I ceased to speak of the British Empire, using the term Commonwealth of Nations instead. With this shift, his investigation into the idea of organic union could not be completed without turning the attention to both India and Egypt, the two dependencies with the strongest claims on self-government. Previously, organic union had only included white subjects. In this understanding, India and Egypt, like the other dependencies, were to be governed in the interest of the governed themselves. Indeed, a document prepared for the moot, as the roundtable gatherings were called, after the house in Johannesburg where the fortnightly club had first met, Leo Amery noted that an organic union had to deal with, quote, a group of autonomous democratic British communities on subjects of common interest, and the efficient administration and development of a number of dependencies inhabited by populations of every conceivable race, some of them still in the lowest forms of civilization, and all of them as yet unfit for responsible self-government. These categories, Curtis argued, called for different methods and different qualities in the men who are responsible for these methods. But in Curtis's new understanding, the self-government of dependencies was integral to the development of British institutions themselves. After the Dominion tours, discussions with the moot focused on India and Egypt's place in their schemes. As Curtis's biographer had pointed out, organic union only required the territorial presence of dependencies in the empire, but the principle of commonwealth had to include their peoples as future imperial citizens. Other members of the moot rejected these suggestions, while Curtis's close associate, Robert Brand, told him, I intend that the white man shall always be top dog. I'm not at all sure that your thinking is consistent with mutual citizenship in a commonwealth. Curtis saw the British Commonwealth as a natural progression from organic union, where British dependencies had advanced far enough the racial hierarchy to be included in the Imperial Brotherhood. In 1916, Curtis visited India, where he wrote a text on Indian self-government that was crucial to governmental reforms. However, the inclusion of India and Egypt in the imperial scheme was only an affirmation of the neo-racist view that some non-Western cultures were more teachable than others. In December 1918, Curtis anonymously published an article in the Roundtable entitled Windows of Freedom, calling on the League of Nations to delegate the responsibility of governing derelict territories to some democratic power. Through this, Curtis became influential in formulating the mandate system, formalizing the liberal racialized world order. It is clear that Curtis was also influenced by the ideas of Philip Kerr and Alfred Zimmern on the issue of mandates. Jan Smuts, who is often credited as the architect of the mandate system of the League of Nations, consulted Curtis's article when he researched his own proposals on the mandate issue. These issues were more concretely expressed in Curtis's text, Civitas Dei. In this 1,000-page tome, Curtis made a case for global commonwealth of nations operating on two levels, one comprising the Western nations of civilized non-white countries like India and Egypt, and the other, the rest of the non-West. For him, notwithstanding a change in thinking, the notion of world government continued to represent a racialized world order. It was with this goal in mind that the new mode of study was disseminated throughout the empire. IR methodology and dissemination. Besides spreading the idea of, quote, organic union, Curtis's Dominion tour was a fact-finding mission, during which he studied the four countries, allowing these experiences to shape both his broader political objectives and the means for achieving them. It was this encounter, we believe, that sowed the seeds of international relations' original method. One of the lesser-known contributions of the kindergarten, and especially Curtis, was the notion that, quote, scientific research should guide both understandings of the changing world and policy recommendations that would shape it. Their approach invents a narrow, empiricist understanding of knowledge. It continues to guide IR think tank research across the world. As with IR itself, Curtis's scheme for a reconfigured empire was underpinned by a strange yet absolute moral certainty, namely that the scientific study of international relations would lead to peace. But how did IR's founders come to define what the scientific study of international affairs meant? To address this, we must return to pre-Union South Africa and to Curtis's Dominion tour. In the course of both, Curtis used a method of study that helped to shape what became the Royal Institute of International Affairs and its affiliates' scientific method that shortly spread through the Dominions and eventually across the world. In preparing statements for their projects, the researchers undertook field tours. This first began in South Africa, but as we noted, continued on a far grander scale during Curtis's tour of the Dominions. During his travels, Curtis would study secondary sources and conduct extensive interviews with influential and knowledgeable individuals. On the basis of facts gleaned from these sources, a report would be drafted for circulation among a select group across the Dominions. Following this, wider self-selecting groups would discuss the draft and enter their comments into interleaved copies. These copies would be sent back to Curtis, and who would then prepare the next draft. At every iteration, the, quote, method involved fieldwork, interviewing, library research, drafting, and an early form of peer review. The final draft was only completed after this long process. For example, after his interactions with people in Canada in late 1909 and early 1910, Curtis wrote a draft report entitled Memoranda on Canada and the British Commonwealth, also called the Green Memorandum. He finished this draft in South Africa between March and May of 1911 and sent it to London, where Kerr made copies to be delivered to Curtis when he reached New Zealand. Curtis distributed these to people in New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and South Africa. He drew on the resulting comments from about 200 such roundtable members in drafting his imperial statement, which was finally released in 1914. This closed transnational process enabled a male-dominant, all-white thought collective to construct a new imperial vision of the world. Curtis emphasized the, quote, scientific nature of the self-enclosed method and sought to cloak the work under the legitimacy of scholarship. In two different memorandums, one written at the end of his trip to New Zealand and the other after leaving Canada in early 1910, he set out the background of the kindergarten's approach to these issues in South Africa and discussed the importance of the method in achieving his goals. In all of his writings, he claimed to be applying the methods of scientific study to politics. Even in personal conversations with potential participants, Curtis emphasized the objectivity of his work. In a letter to Kerr, he wrote of his difficulties in the Dominions to prove that he was not a propagandist. The only way that I can meet this is to show them the books we produced in South Africa, and to show them then how again and again, as a result of study, we had to discard ideas which we had long held. Our whole experience in South Africa has taught us there that if we sit down to get back to the facts and to review them on their merits, we are likely, before we have done, to be brought to a conclusion which we little anticipated. The, quote, scientific study of political issues, which would become the scientific study of international relations, was driven by several considerations which need to be underscored. Firstly, as Curtis frequently made clear, there was the emphasis of the, quote, objective nature of the study, which would make others less apprehensive of the overall projects. Given this insistence, the assertion of objectivity should not be uncritically accepted. As we have shown, the ideas operated within racial discourses were influenced by the group's goals for the empire. Moreover, the closed community within which they worked makes plain the process was far from open. Secondly, the desired quest for rigor was judged as the best way of ascertaining, quote, the facts, which would establish the, quote, truth. The latter would emerge once the, quote, facts had been written down and tested by the criticism of men like themselves and all countries concerned. Once this truth was revealed, Curtis would begin to do the missionary work with real effect. As he once put it, quote, until I have got a doctrine I can preach, I am conscious of being utterly paralyzed so far as influencing the current course of affairs is concerned. It was no surprise then that he quickly earned the moniker of the prophet within the militantly missionary roundtable movement. Thirdly, the attention to method points a significant but understudied aspect of early IR, the purported cognitive link between knowledge and reality. The kindergarten's work in South Africa and the roundtable's work in the Dominions reflected a strong belief that knowledge created reality. This understanding was rooted in the 19th century British tradition of, quote, knowing, primarily reflected and influenced by Herbert Spencer's belief that human nature was constantly evolving and that human history reflected the eternal march of progress. In this understanding, the purpose of science was to empirically establish the history of progress and authenticate its telos. Once this was done, human agency was required for propaganda purposes only. Kerr was confident, as he wrote to Curtis during the Dominion tour, that once the truth had been revealed during the imperial statement, it would then only need a few publicly spirited men in each Dominion to shout hurrah in a spontaneous manner to create a movement for the end goal, the creation of an imperial union. In 1919, when the Royal Institute of International Affairs was established, the inaugural memorandum prepared by Curtis referred to the crucial link between historical progress, knowledge, and reality. Aside from underscoring this philosophy of, quote, scientific study, perhaps the most crucial direct outcome of the Dominion tour was the founding of the journal The Round Table, which showcased, quote, scientific research in imperial and international politics and carried policy recommendations. The idea of the Round Table emerged in a meeting between Curtis, Maris, and the Canadian journalist John Willison in Toronto. The original plan was to establish magazines modeled on The State, which had been published in South Africa, in each of the Dominions. However, Willison argued that there had to be an organ for communication across all Dominions. Curtis hoped that besides connecting people across the Dominions, the journal could also broadcast information about the Dominions to each other, and in the same manner in which The State had done in South Africa. To achieve this, each edition of the journal would carry articles from different parts of the empire. Faced with these, quote, facts, people would discover common and better appreciate why imperial union was necessary. The public face of the journal would also enable the roundtable to dispel the impression that it was a secret society while garnering supporters across the Dominions. On February 25, 1910, a plan for a common journal was adopted by the Moot in London. A committee was formed to guide its affairs comprising Brand, Oliver, Robinson, Kerr, and Peterson. Replicating their South African roles in the Imperial Project, Curtis was to tour the various parts of the Empire, and Kerr was to manage the magazine from a central office. Soon, however, the tune deferred over the nature and purpose of the journal. Kerr saw the London editorial office as a functional and ideological nerve center and assumed that the Round Table would follow the same role as the state. Curtis disagreed with this notion. In his view, the primary purpose of the Round Table was to collect and disseminate information about the Dominions and the Empire. The propagation of policy would compromise the political neutrality of the journal and make prospective associates in the Dominions apprehensive about the project. It would look as though London was intent to remain the imperial center, and the Dominions were only to serve as appendages to an already settled system. In Kerr's formulation, the articles for inclusion in the journal were to be written in London, or by people selected by the editorial office, with the Dominions only supplying the information. For the first issue, Kerr had asked Willison in Canada and F. Peter Perry in South Africa to contribute. Curtis, however, argued that this would create an unnecessary chain of communication between London and the Dominions, taking initiative away from the Dominions. He insisted that the articles be written by people in the Dominions and that the authors should also be suggested by local groups. Furthermore, every quarter, an article would be written by persons from different groups within the Dominion. Were an article on South Africa in the first issue to be written from the Cape, the next one had to be written from someone from the Transvaal. For the journal to succeed, the Dominions had to feel ownership of the ideas. For his part, Kerr believed the journal would be read by a great majority of men of real influence in politics, journal, business, etc., and that the efforts were underway to inculcate a readership among the people who count, in order that from the outset it may reach a larger number of readers. In contrast, Curtis argued that the journal should be read by select people who were appreciative of the project. Curtis warned that aiming for high circulation would lead people to regard it as an ambitious journalistic venture, and not the journal to circulate between kindred societies of earnest, laborious students in search of the truth. Such diversions might imbue the project with an atmosphere of political conspiracy and give the very impression which would at once be fatal. The specter of the state loomed over this particular part of the exchange between Curtis and Kerr, because that journal had by now become a popular magazine rather than one with a focus on statehood. Funded by Abe Bailey, who also funded the state in its initial year, the Roundtable could afford to restrict its circulation to 200 to 500 people in each of the Dominions. The first volume of the Roundtable appeared in November of 1910, in the middle of Curtis's Dominion tour. By then, Kerr had agreed to all of Curtis's suggestions. Interestingly, India had been included in its contents, with Maris arguing that, quote, the educated and highly intelligent Indian might be able to govern themselves at some far-off point, but also praising the more generous and kinder approach to government that the British had begun to take. The introductory essay argued for British unity and stated that the journal's goal was to dispel the ignorance each of the Dominions had for one another in order to bring them closer together. This optimistic goal was, however, tempered, as the following suggests. Quote, the founders of the Round Table have an uneasy sense that the times are changing, and that the methods of yesterday will not serve in the competition of tomorrow. They feel that the various communities of the Empire have common interest. They are singularly badly equipped to pursue them. But it believed that the journal would serve its purpose if it contributes to a better understanding of the problems of empire and to their solution, and if no one ever raises the charge against it that it has distorted the truth for its own ends, and so achieving imperial unity would be a natural process. If imperial truths were gathered, the empire could be united by simply disseminating them. Conclusion. In order to end, we need to return to what still passes for the formal beginning of international relations. The Aberystwyth account of the origins of IR conceals more than it reveals. This messianic narrative about IR's birth rising from the ashes of war to bring peace to the world has almost for a century now linked international relations identity to world peace, while conveniently erasing its racial and imperial origins. Where the Aberystwyth account of the discipline's origin sees the creation of, quote, world peace, our work sees an effort to permanently establish an empire organized like South Africa around racial difference. The centenary of the discipline's founding is a reminder that the archival content, transnational context, and historical claims of IR's founding are still too narrow. Deep critical excavations of the politics, sociology, and interest of the pre-disciplinary route suggest different beginnings to the heroic claims which surround the Aberystwyth story. Both the South African story and the Dominion tour, which we have traced on these pages, are crucial precursors to, quote, knowing IR and its modes of, quote, knowing. There is, however, a more deep-seated reason why the disciplinary origins need to be interrogated, and continuously so. IR has long hinged itself on Martin Wright's claim on the international being the zone of exception. As calls for decolonizing the discipline grow, IR Center has used this logic of insularity from the everyday to foreclose debates about its theoretical and empirical agenda. Decolonizing IR would thus first requiring stripping the discipline of its historical certainty and challenging the foundational assumptions of what it means to do IR. Critically considering IR's past would tell us more about its conscious blinkers built through theory. When idealism, for instance, is stripped of its historical abstraction and moral evaluation, it becomes less of a theory and more of a practice for imperial stretch. Increasingly, we will understand that the historical antecedent to the, quote, international is not, quote, anarchy, as the discipline encourages us to believe, but empire structured around the essentialist idea of race.